This is our final session of the year, and on this subject matter of as in the days of Noah. And what I'd like to do this evening is, in a sense, go all the way back to the beginning, not of the Bible, but of our study. And that is that the premise of the study was that it's very possible that the culture in which we live, and not just ours, the Europeans, etc., we could be prophetically in a place where a lot of the things are in place for the rapture of the church and the second coming of Christ. Jesus alludes to the fact that his second coming is parallel in many ways to the days of Noah. So we looked at the days of Noah, and then we looked at a lot of different things in our culture and how we have changed. And then we went into a general overview of prophecy and ended last time with the millennial kingdom. And what I want to do today is answer the most important question of anything you ever study in the Bible, but particularly when you're just studying something like prophecy, because it's a question we don't often ask. And the question is, so what? You know, the most important question every time you say anything that you've learned in the Bible, ask yourself that. If you tell me, sometimes people tell me what they learned in the Bible, and I'll say it to them. So what? In other words, there's got to be a reason that you learn certain truths. And what I think is the case is, if our culture is in decline, how does that affect you and me? In other words, how should we respond in light of what's going on culturally around us? And what I want to do tonight is I want to use an example of someone who not only survived a culture more difficult than ours, but had an enormous impact on the culture. And his conditions were exponentially worse than yours will ever be in your lifetime in this culture. His name is Daniel. And when you think of the book of Daniel, a lot of times I think we make a big mistake. When we teach our children the book of Daniel in the Learning Center or a Sunday school class or VBS or whatever, it's almost taught like an adventure book. And there's always these two great stories that you want to teach the children. You want to teach them the story of Daniel in the lion's den, because that's really impressive. You know, I mean, he was in a lion's den overnight. And the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in a fiery furnace, and they survived. But let me be extremely clear about this. Virtually, as far as I know, any believer in the history of the world who was put in a lion's den were eaten by the lions, except for Daniel. And everybody I know who's either burned at the stake or burned in a furnace was burned up. So the idea that Daniel is the model, like, you know, I mean, you could be in a lion's den. Those were exceptions. It's not an adventure story. So the second thing we often do is they say, well, what it is it's a catalog of prophecy. That's what the book is. And there is a great deal of prophecy in it. But from an applicational point of view, the book of Daniel teaches us something that's extremely important, and that is, how do I survive and spiritually thrive in an extremely anti-God culture? And that's exactly what Daniel does. If you think of the changes in our culture, the best way I could put it over the last 100 years is, 100 years ago, if you were an evangelical Christian, you believed the gospel, you had a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, I would say what you got from the culture was grudgingly respect. And the reason it's grudgingly is, even then, 100 years ago, most of the people that would call themselves quote-unquote Christian in our culture were just church people. They just want the church. And that's what they viewed Christianity as. Christianity is you go to church. Doesn't matter if it's a Catholic church or a Protestant church, you go to church, that makes you Christian. When you ever somebody started talking about a day in, day out personal relationship with Jesus Christ and that Christ is the most important thing in life and he affects everything you do at every moment, they really didn't get much of that. They didn't really understand what you were doing, but they respected it, but they didn't give much. Then the culture changed a little bit and sort of gave us a sort of patronizing pat on the head. You know, it's just sort of that thing like, oh, you know, you're a little bit weird, but, you know, it's kind of nice. But about 50 years ago, the culture began to change, and it changed a little bit from that. The first thing the culture did is they sort of had a marginal indifference to us. They didn't really care about us much. Now, in the last 20 years, something has changed, and the culture is showing outright hostility. That's for the first time for us. And so we view that as, wow, this is just so hard. This is going to be so bad. This is going to be so difficult for us. And yet what we don't understand is in almost every culture in the world right now where Christianity is practiced, and historically virtually every culture that's ever existed, it was much, much, much worse for God's people. We just don't really understand that. Daniel is in the Babylonian culture. And yet this culture, as we'll look at several things here, this culture is, in every way you could measure it, much, much worse than ours. And certainly if you're a believer. And yet Daniel thrived. I mean, and the circumstances in which he even got there are very, very different than the circumstances you and I got here. It's a very different kind of thing. And so in Daniel chapter 1, I want you to go to Daniel chapter 1 with me. And when I think of Daniel, I think of it, and why did Daniel thrive so much? I think he had three characteristics that he had that we should have. He had hope, he had humility, he had wisdom. He had hope and humility and wisdom, and that gave him courage and credibility and perspective. Daniel's response, by the way, to the wicked leaders of his culture, to us as American evangelicals, seems counterintuitive. You see, to us, it's like, no, that's not that. We should never do that. Some of us would view someone as great as Daniel as, boy, he's a compromiser. You see, that's why there's so much to learn from him. The background is, by the way, for Daniel, is that here's a kid, he was probably 16, 17, 18 maybe. He's of royal lineage, he's impressive, and as far as I know, he has a great relationship with God. And then all of a sudden, his country is invaded by the Babylonians, and he's carried off all the way from Judah to Babylon. He was sort of caught in the backwash. Didn't do it himself, he just got caught off. And yet, here's what's amazing about it. When we see all the difficulties of his life, not once in the book of Daniel. Now, remember, he's going to live his whole life hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles from where he should be living. He never once complains. Not one time. He never once whines. Not one time. He never complains about the culture he's in at all. And you got to understand the circumstances in which he's in this culture. You see, one of the things that Daniel had is he had a tremendous amount of hope. And what I mean by that is, when we say hope, we mean, boy, I hope this works out. But biblical hope is exactly the opposite. Biblical hope is certitude for the future. In other words, biblical hope is, I am absolutely certain of the future. He had that. That's why the Apostle Paul calls the second coming of Jesus the blessed hope. The happy hope of the church. Paul wasn't saying, cross your fingers, guys. Let's just hope he comes back. He's not saying that. Paul said, he's coming back. That's my hope. That's my certitude. Daniel had that. Notice what Daniel writes right in the beginning, the first two verses. He said, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Now watch what he writes. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them into the land of Shinar. That's what we looked at that in Genesis 9 through 11. He says, to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Wow. Notice the phrase. Why did Daniel's life get so bad? I'll tell you why. Because of those terrible, crummy Babylonians. Those horrible pagans. That's why my life became bad. He said, no. He said, the Lord gave Judah to Babylon. That's his perspective. In other words, he believes right off the bat, God is sovereign. If he were in the New Testament, he might have quoted Romans 8:28. First thing I want to say, by the way, now that I'm in Babylon, is all things work together for the good, including this. You see, if the Lord is behind everything, that changes everything. That's called the sovereignty of God. The question for you, living in the world in which we live, in our culture, is how big is your God? And here's my own perspective of this. For many Christians, our Babylon is bigger than our God. And the reason I know that is the way we talk. Oh, it's just terrible. It's so terrible out there. It's just terrible. So what? It's always been terrible. You know when it got terrible? The Garden of Eden. You see, it got terrible in the Garden of Eden. Now, I know what you're saying. No, it's so much worse, and I'm guilty of that myself. So hold your place here and go with me to a verse that I just love. Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and verse 10. Solomon writing. Solomon says this, do not say, that's commanded, it's an intensive, it's PL in Hebrew. Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? Have you ever said that? You see it? Notice Solomon said, do not say, why are the former days better than these? Now, here's God's perspective of that kind of thinking. For it is not from wisdom that you ask about this. It's not wisdom. You see, in a sense, there really aren't any good old days. It was just different old days. It has a perspective. By the way, one of the reasons that the good old days are so good to us is the good old days for many of us was when we grew up and we were children. And one of the great things about being a child is you're pretty much not aware of what's going on at all. And as long as you have a pretty happy childhood, they were great days. But if you think about it, we talk about, baby boomers talk about, you know, the good old days. I mean, that's when America was really good. I mean, when I was young, America was really good. I mean, I was fortunate enough that in growing up in the 60s, that I went to Kent State University. And you know how good that place was? The American National Guard shot American students on their campus. Isn't that neat? That's so good. That's when it was really good, not like these campuses now. American National Guard shot students. America entered a war that had no point. None. 58,000 young men died. 500,000 wounded for nothing. Oh, that was a good old days. And by the way, I mean, we had LSD and drugs and hippies. Oh, and another thing, we shot presidents back then. We assassinated people. See, that was the good old days. That's when it was really good. You have to be careful with that. You see, you have to be really careful with that. I have a hunch that, and by the way, what's interesting, if you read historically or historical figures, you can read people who wrote in the 19th century, the 18th century, the 17th century, and as they're writing, guess what they write? The world is not very good now, not nearly as good as when I was young. It doesn't really matter. Solomon wrote 1,000 years before Christ, and he said, hey, don't say that. Why did he say don't say that? Because what were people saying? That. People said that. It's not like it was when I was young. It was a lot better then. Do you know what our grandchildren will say? When they're our age, boy, the world's not near as good as it was when I was young. It's just our nature. You see, we have a tendency to view everything from that perspective. Daniel is surrounded by evil, but he believes God is in control. He does not, by the way, when I say sovereignty, I don't mean that God made people sin. James 1, God says, when anyone says that, even if they, you know, when they sin or even when they're tempted, I'm being tempted by God. God said, I can't tempt anybody. I don't tempt him. But I am sovereign over sin. I am sovereign over the choices of men. I am sovereign over the earth since the fall. By the way, we know that, by the way, that's what all the prophecy is. Why is all the prophecy written like that? Because you know what God said? No matter what men are like, it's going to end up happening just the way I said. And it's going to come to a conclusion just the way I said. And the reason for it is, I'm sovereign. Daniel gets that in the beginning. He didn't even blame the Babylonians. He said, the Lord gave us over to them. Now, there's something else here that you find out. He doesn't find himself in any city. He finds himself in Babylon. Now, remember, we looked at that. If you start in Genesis with Babylon, the Tower of Babel, and you go all the way to Revelation 18, Babylon, the great, the mother of harlots. Babylon is the personification of evil. Daniel says, yeah, I know. I lived my whole life there. Virtually my whole life. You see, it's a very evil place. It's not benign. It's not neutral. It wasn't Switzerland. And by the way, Babylon had a king. His name was Nebuchadnezzar. Now, once Daniel's there for a while, by the way, he serves four kings. Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, his son, Darius, and Cyrus. Daniel has a long, long time there. Two different kingdoms, Babylonians and Persians. But Nebuchadnezzar, let me just say a few things about him that makes, he's the leader. Now understand, when you're a king, it doesn't mean you're an elected official. And it doesn't mean you need the House and Senate to help you along the way. When you're king, you're king. You do and say what you want. Nebuchadnezzar is an egomaniac. He's murderous, he's vain, and he's cruel. And he is certainly anti-God when this starts. Let me show you a little bit about Nebuchadnezzar, the kind of man he is. Look at chapter 2 of Daniel. And this is one of the things that he said. Now, he gets together, he has a dream. And he gets together all of his most learned men. Now, these men are what we would call often mystics, magicians, astrologers. But they're the men you use. They're your count. But they're the smartest guys you got. And so here's what he does. In verse 5, it says, the king answered, and he said to the Chaldeans, he said, the command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream, he said, and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. Now, please understand what he did. He had a dream. It bothered him, and he said, I want to bring you in. Now, they're used to that. And Nebuchadnezzar's a smart man, and he knows that most of the time they probably just blow smoke at him. Oh, great king, this dream means, and then they tell him. He says, okay, well, I'm not going to do that this time. Tell me the dream. Now they're in a difficult spot. Tell me the dream and then interpret it. Or I'll get the horses, and they did this, by the way, and I'll tie your legs and four horses in your arms, and I'll just pull them off your body. Then I'll go to your home, and I'll burn it down with your family in it. Who does that? Nebuchadnezzar. Because that's the kind of guy he is. You see, that's the kind of guy he is. Not just there. Look at chapter 3. Chapter 3 and verse 5. This is the preamble to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He says, verse 4 actually, the herald loudly will proclaim, to you the command is given, O peoples and nations and men of every language, everyone within earshot that had been carried off to Babylon, that at the moment that you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image of Nebuchadnezzar, the king has set up. And oh, by the way, whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. That's the culture he's in. I've made this big statue of myself and you worship. You don't worship, you die right now. You're going to burn alive. Now, what kind of leader do you think this guy is? You see, I mean, we think, oh man, Stalin and Hitler, those guys are really bad. They were. They weren't any worse than this guy. I mean, that's who he is. And there's no appeal. Now, not only, so you have a godless king. Now, let's go back to Daniel 1. It says, that then the king ordered Ashpenaz, he said, the chief of the officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles. He said, now he's going to describe them. That's why Daniel was probably from a royal family. It says, youths in whom there is no defect. So when he was carried off, and by the way, as a slave, he probably walked from Jerusalem to Babylon. They didn't give you a ride. Notice they could have no defects, who were good looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, who had an ability for serving in the king's court. Wow. He said they got to be perfect. No defects. That was always viewed as a curse from the gods in any culture. Handsome. Smart. Learned. And they're going to serve with me. See, that's what a king like Nebuchadnezzar do, take the best of the best, especially young, and have them serve in that court. That's one of the reasons they were so powerful. Many of those others in that were asked to interpret the dream got there the same way. In lands that were conquered, he took the best of the best. Now watch what happens. It says, he ordered them to teach him the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. Now that's kind of an interesting thing, but it also says a little bit later that in verse 3, it says that they should be appointed that they should be educated for 3 years. So they go into an education. And by the way, he's not only taken off into captivity, made a slave, but he's going to have to serve the king that took him off into captivity, and he's going to be completely indoctrinated. He's going to be taught the occult. That's what the advisors do. He's going to be called the mysticism, the magic, and astrology. He's going to be taught the occult of the Chaldean Empire for 3 years. By the way, you know what Daniel said about that? Nothing. Did he protest it? No. No. Why? I mean, we'd be fighting, wouldn't we? Daniel's view is a little bit different. He said, it doesn't matter what they teach. It only matters how I live. You know, I'm not threatened because someone is teaching lies. Not at all. They can teach all the lies they want. But that's not going to threaten me. Now, we're really big. No, make sure no one ever teaches a lie to anybody. They can't do that to our kids. They do. You see, it didn't. That's one of the things I enjoyed at the University of Pittsburgh. I majored in philosophy. Jesus Christ didn't come up much. Unless they were making fun of him. It didn't affect me. Oh, that made me not love Jesus. It didn't affect me. You see, Daniel doesn't go anywhere. But watch what happens. Back to 4 of... Actually, verse 5, it says, and the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank. And he says, and appointed that they should be educated for the 3 years, at the end of which they would enter in the king's personal service. Wow. Now, in one way, you got to be a really lucky slave. There's probably nobody in that part of the whole world that would have been given better meals than these kids. This is Nebuchadnezzar's food. This is the best of the best. There's only a problem with it, though. One, a lot of it has been already offered to a pagan god. And Exodus 34 says that Jews can't do that. And two, it's certainly not kosher. Now, this is interesting because Daniel knows that God commanded him specifically about that. So watch what happens. Down to verse 8. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine in which he drank. And so he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now, what's that tell you? I can tell you what it tells me. Daniel is willing to die on the hill for this. You see, I won't violate God. I will not violate my relationship with God. But notice how wise he is the way he handles it. Verse 9, now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. This guy likes him a lot. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I love this, I'm afraid, my lord, the king who has appointed your food and your drink, for why should he says, for why should he see your faces looking more haggard than these, the other youths your own age? And then he says, you will make me forfeit my head to the king. Hey, he'll kill me for this. You know why? He's that kind of guy. He sees you guys not eating this great food. Now remember, what kind of state do you think Daniel and his friends got there in? Pretty ragged. Remember, they just walked from Jerusalem to Babylon. And by the way, the conquering army didn't know what they would do with them until they got back there. So the king says, look, I want these guys, these are the best of the best. I want them to have the best food, the best education, the best everything. But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, he said, please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Now, by the way, did you ever think, like, I really need to gain about 15 or 20 pounds, so I'm just going to go with water and vegetables? I mean, it doesn't sound right, does it? But it sounds right to Daniel. Then notice, he said, then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and then deal with your servants according to what you see. Now, he didn't say we'd eat the food. He said, then you can deal with us the way you want. This guy has a lot of moxie. He's a kid. He has a lot of moxie. So he listened to them in the matter and tested them for 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, their appearance seemed better. And he says, and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. And so the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and wine, he says, that they were to drink, and kept giving them vegetables. So, one thing you know, you want to teach me black magic, astrology, and all that stuff, the occult, go ahead. But I will not violate the laws that God's given my people about eating. I will not do that. This is kind of an interesting thing. Now, watch what happens as you take it a step further. Now, the next step you have is that you have this hostile environment saying a few different things. For example, go back to verse 6. Now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. To Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar. He says, to Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, he said, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. Now I'll just deal with Daniel, but they're all mean the same thing. Daniel's a great Jewish name. Got the E-L at the end. Daniel's name is God is my judge. I imagine his parents were very proud of that name. Belshazzar. Bel is the word that is used the way we use the word Lord for Marduk. You see, when it said that Nebuchadnezzar took all the stuff in the temple and put it in Marduk's temple, Marduk, by the way, is the Babylonian version of a guy we ran into, Nimrod. And the Babylonians then took Nimrod's wife, which was Semiramis, and they changed their name to Ashtarte, which we get Easter from. This is Marduk. This is a pagan deity. Remember the Apostle Paul in the New Testament said, behind every idol is a demon. So if you think about it from that point of view, He changed his name to Bel's, Marduk's lord, Bel's prince. That's what Daniel's name now is. You're Bel's prince. In other words, they took his name, and by the way, we all know this. The names mean much to the Jews in the scripture. It means everything. So we're going to change your name. You're not going to be God is my judge. You're going to be Marduk's prince. Every one of them get a pagan deity name. And do you know what Daniel said about it? Nothing. Not a word. He's fine. Now, it's not written in the book of Proverbs, but it should be, because it's been a proverb you grew up with. Sticks and stones, right? May break my bones, but names will never hurt me. Daniel said, I'm not going to die on the hill of what you call me. No, that's fine. You want to call me that? Call me that. By the way, as you go on in the book, and he starts getting so much respect, guess what they call him? The kings often call him Daniel. Daniel's God. Once he does some certain things. So that's an amazing thing. His name is changed. And he lets him change the name. So here's a guy carried off, torn from his family, made into a slave. He has to be trained into a cult teaching. He's going to be in the king's personal service. His name is changed to a demonic name. And oh, by the way, something else that's very, very likely. He and his friends are castrated. 18-year-old guy. By the way, never says a word about it. Didn't matter to him. Not enough to whine or complain about it. You say, well, how do you know he's castrated? Well, a couple reasons will lead us to this. First of all, one of the reasons that we know that he's castrated is he's going to work where? In the king's royal court, in his presence. He's going to be right there. Now, you have to understand, when you get to the inner court of a king, especially back in this period of history, and even for long history after that, you are not only in proximity of the king, but you're also in proximity of Nebuchadnezzar's harem. And it's probably for Nebuchadnezzar extremely large. And it would include, the girls in the harem would go probably from 12 up. That's usually what the kings did. There's something else. You notice when it says in verse 3, then the king ordered Eliphaz, the chief of the officials, that he is the commander. And then remember I said that Daniel talked to him, the commander of the officials. The word there that is used is the word Cyrus or Sarus. The word is Sarus. Other than right here, 15 times in the Old Testament that word is used. And guess how it's translated? Eunuch. Sarus is castrated. He's a chief advisor. He's in the presence of the king. That's normal. That's typical. By the way, what kind of young men were these guys? How'd they look? Not too many men in Bible called good looking. These are handsome young men. These are virile, handsome young men. So how do you think you'd feel in that situation? Daniel never mentions it. See, he never saw it as a disgrace. And by the way, it's way more important to him than it is to us. Why? Most important thing you can have if you're a Jewish man is what? A son. Why? He gets the land. By the way, you don't have a son, your family's cut off from the land. That means everything to him. You'll never see in the book of Daniel ever. No wife, no children. Now that to us would be, and see what I'm describing is, how terrible a situation would this be? You're conquered. You're disenfranchised. You're taken out. You're gone all the way to Babylon. Now, this is a pagan culture. And here is Daniel. And notice, they change his name. I'm okay with that. They castrate him. I'm okay with that. They train him in the way of the Chaldeans. I'm okay with that. No, but I'm not going to eat food that's not kosher. He understands what, you see, what he'll accept and what he won't. He's very, very good that way. And he gets a great deal of approval from God for what he does. Now, there's something else then. Not only does he do all this, But you would think that the whole notion of being conquered and taken out of the land would bother you. The Jews view themselves as what? Chosen people. And what is their land called beside Canaan? It's called the Promised Land. Could there be anything more unimaginable to a Jew than be taken out of his land? It happened. It happened then, and it happened again in 70 AD. But I want you to see how the normal response could be to this, and then the spiritual response. So you can hold your place here, but let's go to the book of Habakkuk. Habakkuk. Right before Zephaniah. Come on. All right, after Nahum. Now, Habakkuk, his response in the beginning is amazing. In verse 2, he says, "How long, O Lord, will I call for help and you will not hear? I cry out to you, violence, and yet you do not save." He says, "Why do you make me see iniquity and cause me to look on wickedness? The destruction and the violence are before me. Strife exists and contention arises." And therefore, he says, "The law is ignored and justice is never upheld. And the wicked surround the righteous." And the justice, he said, is being perverted. Verse 6, he says, "For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people who march throughout the earth to seize dwelling places which are not theirs. They are dreaded and feared. Their justice," he said, "and authority originate with themselves." It's interesting. What he's saying is, why are you doing this? Why is this happening to us? By the way, as an evangelical Christian, we often ask those questions about the change in our culture. Why is this happening? Now, what's interesting about it is God's answer is kind of fascinating, but basically, the first thing God does with Habakkuk, he says, "Hey, you don't worry about the Chaldeans. I'll take care of the Chaldeans when the time comes." You see, why were they taken off into the Babylonian captivity and experienced that culture? Because that culture, evil was so powerful that evil just overcame them, to a degree. But why did they get taken out of the land? Because God did. They were judged by God. Did you ever think about this in a way that the declining conditions in America may be because God is judging the church in America? He's not judging the pagan culture, he's judging us. You see, you don't have to leave to go into captivity. You don't have to leave to be surrounded by a pagan culture. And it's happening to us. But we went off, I think a lot of evangelicals view that it's not us, it's them. It's them, it's not us. I'd be very careful thinking about it that way. By the way, I won't go through the whole book, but let's go to the end of Habakkuk. I love the way Habakkuk concludes it. He says in verse 17 of chapter 3, Habakkuk says this. He says, "Though the fig tree should not blossom, and there should be no fruit on the vines, and though the yield of the olive should fail," that's economic ruin, he said, "and the fields produce no food, and though the flock," he said, "should be cut off from the fold, and there be no cattle in the stalls." Now, he just described an absolute worst-case scenario. Now, notice what he says next. "Yet I will exult in the Lord. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength, and he has made my feet like hinds' feet and makes me walk," he says, "on my high places." See what his point is? Habakkuk finally gets it. He says, it doesn't really matter what my circumstances are. But in the beginning, he acted just like we do. Hey, would it be more wonderful to be in an easy set of circumstances? Maybe. You see, maybe. But why did God send them to Babylon? One, he judged their sin. Two, he revealed the bankruptcy of their faith. And three, I'm sure he did something else. He thinned the herd. To me, that's one of the most exciting things that probably will happen in the next 20 years in America. If the persecution goes from just contempt, which they have to us now, to active persecution, it'll be interesting to see how many less people show up in churches. You see, and God does that. He'll thin the herd. It's going to cost something. Almost everywhere in the world for the history of the church, it's cost something. We've had this tremendous luxury of it costing us almost nothing. But it's changing now. So, Daniel had this hope, this tremendous hope that he had. And his hope was in God. See, one of the things that Daniel was given was the visions and interpretation. And the reason for it is this. Daniel, through his visions, was given the idea of what God was saying to him. Daniel, it's terrible right now. This is a horrible situation you're in. But I want to show you where it's all going. And by the way, he saw where it was all going. His one image, remember Nebuchadnezzar, he says, Nebuchadnezzar, you're here. You're the head. But by the way, you're going to get pushed out. Persians and the Chaldeans and the Persians are coming. They're going to take over. The Mede Persians are going to take over. And then they're going to get pushed out. And then the Greeks are going to come. And then the Romans. But it's all going to be done. Daniel gives us all these basic prophecies. And the idea is he's given prophecies to a man who's in captivity in the most pagan culture you could be in. Why does he do that? So that you have hope. Daniel has hope. Now, I want to think about you. You hear me say this all the time. The worst thing that could happen to you can't happen to you. Now, why do I say that? Because I think it's clever. No. Because it's hope. You see, one thing I know, I have a certitude about. I know where I'm going. And get this, I not only know where I'm going, I know where the world's going. We just studied it. I know a lot more about where the world's going than Daniel did. Daniel only had a few images. I have Daniel and Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Zephaniah and Zechariah. I have the Olivet Discourse of Christ and the book of Revelation. I know right where the world's going, and I know right where I'm going. Now, on the basis of those things, what should that give me? Hope. And by the way, a little peace. You see, these circumstances may not be very good, but my God is. You see, it comes down to this perspective that Daniel has. This hope changes everything for him. That's why he's very careful in how he acts. He had something else, though. He also had tremendous humility. When Daniel talks to the kings, it's unbelievable. Oh, great King Nebuchadnezzar, you are the great king. By the way, I started looking for other sources of that. And guess what? The Apostle Paul spoke the same way. When he was brought in front of, whether it's Festus or Agrippa, oh, great king. Wow. You dirty, filthy pagan. No, he doesn't. He talks to them. And he speaks the truth to them in love and with great respect and humility. By the way, we can go back to Daniel. He tells Nebuchadnezzar that Nebuchadnezzar is going to go mad. He says to Nebuchadnezzar, you've exalted yourself too high, O great king. God will judge you because you've done that. And you remember Nebuchadnezzar then was like a cow. He had to eat grass and like an insane man. It's kind of interesting when you look at it and see what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. And then in chapter 4, verse 34 of chapter 4, watch what Nebuchadnezzar says. But at the end of that period, after he was eating grass and humiliated, he was, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, including me. This is Nebuchadnezzar. He says, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and no one can ward off his hand or say to him, why have you done this? Verse 37, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are true and his ways are just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride. I know he did it to me. Now, question, Daniel make an impact in that culture? I mean, that's amazing. By the way, do you think many people would tell Nebuchadnezzar, you're going to go insane because you're too proudful? But he spoke the truth in love. And you know what? Nebuchadnezzar knew it, because Nebuchadnezzar said, this young man is humble before me. This young man would only tell me this if he believes it's true. Remember, he's already interpreted the dream. But it's not just Nebuchadnezzar. Go to chapter 6. Chapter 6. In verse 25. Now we go 2 kings later. Nebuchadnezzar's son Belshazzar's gone. And now Darius is king, Persian. And it says then in verse 25, then Darius, the Persian king, wrote to all the peoples and nations and men of every language who were willing, he said, who were living in the land, may your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. He didn't call him by his Babylonian, he calls him Daniel. He says, for he is the living God and enduring forever, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. His dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, he says, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. It says, so this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus, his successor in Persian. Amazing. What I'm getting at is, notice that Daniel had a tremendous, maybe I'd better say it this way. He had so much passion for God that he had compassion for the lost. You see, Daniel understood something a lot of us don't understand. There's only two kinds of people in the whole world. Saved people and lost people. That's it. You see that? And Daniel really got it. By the way, he knew when to fight his battles, and he did. That's how he got in the lion's den. Think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were also very favored by Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar said, come on, guys, you got to worship the idol. And they go, no, we don't. No. He said, you need to think about it. He go, no, I'm sorry, great king. We don't have to think about it. We're not worshiping. And they said that to him in public. Well, Nebuchadnezzar hated that. That's why he heated it up 7 times hotter. And then he got his best warriors and said, you carry them up and throw them in the furnace. And when they carried them up and opened the furnace doors, those guys burnt to death. But notice what they did. They said, we don't know if our God's going to deliver us, but he's able. But by the way, either way, we'll be with him. So it really doesn't matter, but we're not worshiping you. In other words, they picked the battles. What I'm getting at is this is the same thing for us as believers in this culture. You pick the battles. You see, if our culture got to the point it said, it's illegal for you to own or teach the Bible, then I'll own and teach a Bible with a Bible. And I'll say, if you do that, we'll put you in jail. Then they said, put me in jail. You see, if the culture says it's illegal for you to not have an abortion, well, I'm sorry, but I'm not having an abortion. You can do what you want, but I'm not. You see, you pick, what is the battle? Where do I fight? But the idea that the people in our culture live despicable lifestyles, what am I doing? What do I expect of them? Well, I expect unsaved people to live a lot more decently than that. Why? On what basis? I mean, even we as believers aren't living that decently. You see, God's judgment on our country may have a lot more to do with us than it does with them. Now, when you watch these stories, you think, well, that's a neat story and that works, but I'll show you how different it is in our country. Let's just say that we had a new tribes missionary working on Borneo, like James Porch was, and they're in a primitive culture. And so he comes and they present the ministry of the church on a Sunday morning. And then they have a prayer card. And on the prayer card, they have a picture of Umba. Now, Umba is the witch doctor in the village who very much opposes them and wants to keep the village enslaved to demonic worship. But the missionary says to us, I want you to pray for this because Umba and I have established a relationship. We are befriended each other. And now I am talking on a daily basis to Umba about Jesus Christ. And would you pray for him? And you would probably take it home, put it on the refrigerator, and say, hey, hon, we better pray for Umba today. You know, we think that's really wonderful. Okay? Now, I would say, as the pastor of the church, by the way, I want you to pray for some people that have become close to me. There's an Islamic imam in the city, and I've become friends with him, and you need to pray for him. The president of the Gay and Lesbian Alliance and I are becoming friends, and I want you to pray for him as we continue to talk. Do you notice how you thought differently? You have no reason to think differently. There is no difference between Umba, the witch doctor. You see what ends up happening? All of a sudden, we go into a different mindset. No, not them. We have no right to do that. You see, don't make the mistake of Jonah. You see, remember Jonah? Remember God said, look, I want you to go to Nineveh. And what did Jonah say? I hate those people. I hate them all. And by the way, would you have reason to hate the Assyrians? You bet. Jonah said, I hate them. I'm not going to do what God says. I just hate them. Daniel never did that. By the way, one other man in the Old Testament never did it either. His name was Joseph. Now, you want to hear something really interesting and unusual? Of all the great characters in the Bible who get a lot written about them, there's only two characters beside Jesus Christ who are never described as sinning. Daniel and Joseph. Isn't that interesting? Two men who lived in pagan cultures, and by the way, were indoctrinated in pagan cultures, and were described as righteous men. You see, I think we're way more like Jonah. Now, the good thing about even being like Jonah is the book of Jonah teaches one thing. God can use you in spite of yourself. Because remember, Jonah led a revival, then went up on the hill and wanted to watch them all die. And they all got saved, and it made him mad. But God still used them. Now, having said that, I want you to think this. Daniel did the right thing despite being kidnapped, castrated, forced to study in the occult, had his name changed to honor a demon, and was forced to serve a wicked king. And he thrived in that environment. Now, if he can thrive in that environment, how can we not thrive in ours? You see, it's a mindset. Now, you say, well, that's Old Testament stuff. Okay, where I want to go here at the end is I want to go to Luke chapter 6. I'll let the Lord speak. Luke chapter 6. And verse 27. By the way, even in verse 26, maybe the way our country used to be, but Jesus warns us. Verse 26, he says, woe to you when all men speak well of you. Everybody thinks you're really neat. Maybe you're not standing for anything. He said, woe to you when all men speak well of you, for in the same way their fathers used to treat the false prophets. They loved those guys because they told them what they wanted to hear. Then he says this, though. He said, but I say to you who hear, that means all of us. I say to you who can hear, love your enemies. Wow. Do good to those who hate you. See, do we take that as serious at all as a Christian now? That you would love and do good to those who you know out there hate you? I think we're much more likely to hate them back. You know, it's really an interesting thing. By the way, that's how the Roman Empire was won. Of all the things that the Romans said that was interesting, like Roman historians, they said it was one thing to watch Christians obediently go into the Colosseum and give their life, knowing that they were assured that they would move on to be with their Lord. But as Romans like Seneca said, but what really bothered me is no matter how bad we treated them, they continued to love and treat us well. No matter what we did to them, they just continued to love, treat us well. That converted lots and lots of people. So Jesus says, Love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, and pray for those who mistreat you. That will one day become our government, our culture. Jesus says, yeah, and that's what I want you to do. Notice, I want you to love them, do good to them, bless them, and pray for them. This is hard for us. He says, whoever hits you on the cheek, offer him the other. Whoever takes away your coat, do not withhold your shirt from them either. Give to everyone who asks of you, and whoever takes away what is yours, do not demand it back. And just as you want people to treat you, treat them in the same way. And he says, look, and if you love those who love you, that's who we love, by the way. If you love those who love you, he says, what credit is that to you? He said, even sinners love those who love them. God loved that. Oh, we really love the people that love us. He said, everybody loves the people that love them. Demon worshipers love other demon worshipers who love them. I mean, that's what his point is. What credit is that? He's not saying don't love people who love you, but don't take credit for it. You see, to love people who love you is human. To love people who hate you is divine. You see, what does that require on my part to love people who hate me? It requires that I submit myself to the will of my Savior. And only through his power can I do that. Jesus knows that. He said, if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do the same. If you lend to those who you expect to receive, what credit do you have? Even sinners lend, he said, to sinners in order to receive the same amount back. But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he himself is kind, he says, to ungrateful and evil men. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. While we were at enmity with God, hated him, he reached out to us. He then says, be merciful just as your Father is merciful. See, I don't think we can do this on our own strength. And I think Jesus knows that. We can't. But I know one thing. Jesus is really clear that we should be doing this. And I think what's happening to us within the context of culture is that we just simply do not want to do this. We want to fight. You see, we want to fight these people. Now, there's one thing different in our culture that does make it more difficult for us. I get that. And that's simply because of our form of government. You see, if you were under Nebuchadnezzar's reign, or any great king of the old, or Pharaoh, one thing you knew for sure, you had nothing to say about anything. Nothing. The king decreed what the king decreed, and that's all there was. But remember, when Peter wrote that we are to submit and to pray and honor the king. Peter wrote it when Nero was emperor. Nero's insane. Peter said, yeah, I know. You pray for him, you honor him as king. Why would that be? Best chance to be salt and light in this world. See, the best chance we have to make that kind of an impact. So I think what happens is because we're part of the process, and should be, it's a great idea, we can vote. And sometimes when we vote, some things we vote for win. And sometimes when we vote, some things we vote for lose. And I think because of that process, then we have tremendous animosity to those that we lost to. Because we were trying to win, and then we didn't. So I think democracy in one way makes us adversarial to the culture just on the basis of our involvement in it, because it's all part of the process. You know, I get that. There's not a problem. But one thing I have been able to sort of sort my way through, I have, this is just my opinion, it might not be yours, but I have noticed that whenever people have won public office that I just admired and was so hopeful for, not much ever happened. I mean, almost nothing. And then people that I just loathed and had tremendous fear of, if they ever got power, my life went on just the same. And it taught me one thing. I can't ever put my hope in men or women, but I can't put my hope there. The solution is not. The solution is not political. You know, I think we went through a day and age there as evangelicals, and I get it because the country changed and we're hoping to be able to change it back. But I think we went through a time there where we actually thought, and this is a pretty naive thought, if we do it right, we can legislate righteousness. And then people will be righteous. They will not be. They will not be. They may sin in different forms, but they're still going to sin. See, there really aren't the good old days. I mean, it's just the way it is. We can have an impact in our culture no matter how bad it gets. But we need to follow the example of men like Daniel. It's amazing. His hope, his humility, and his wisdom. And he impacted not just the culture, crazed, lunatic kings of that culture. He impacted them because of the kind of man he was. That's what Jesus is talking about. That's how we impact this culture. Let's pray. Father, thank you for our time, this whole study. Thank you for particularly this session. Thank you for Daniel as an example. I just pray for all of us that we ask ourselves in our heart, is that how we want to react? Is this how we want to feel about living in our culture? Father, because of our love and passion for you, we are to have compassion for those that are lost. You wrote in the Word of God, it's clearly to us that these people are not our enemy. They are the victim of the enemy. And that they can come to Jesus Christ just as we came. It'd be no more difficult to save a pagan king than it would be to save our favorite little aunt. Father, I pray that we understand how important and strategic we are in your plans. And we have nothing to fear. Because you are in control. In Christ's name, amen.